Hello, I'm Kelly Gardner and welcome to Imagining the Past. Imagining the Past is a sneak preview of some of the writers and issues showcased in the 2017 Historical Novel Society Australasia Conference in Melbourne. Starting on the 8th of September, the conference will explore ideas around identity and writing in historical fiction. There'll be interviews, practical workshops, debates, and academic panels. You'll hear from the likes of Kerry Greenwood, Arnold Zabel, Juliet Marillier, and Deborah Challenor, and our podcast guests Kate Forsyth, Lucy Trelaw, Sophie Masson, Solaria Gentile, and Robert Gott. You can find out more or buy tickets online at hnsa.org.au. Today's guest is one of Australia's favourite authors, Kate Forsyth. Kate's novels for adults include Bitter Greens, which won the American Library Association Award for Best Historical Fiction, and The Wild Girl, which was inspired by the true story behind the Grimm Brothers' collection of their famous fairy tales. Her new book, Beauty and Thorns, is out later this year. Kate's books for children include the Chain of Charms series, which won 5 Aurealis Awards for the Best Children's Fantasy, and the best-selling Impossible Quest series. Kate also has a Doctorate of Creative Arts in Fairy Tale Studies, which just sounds fabulous. So Kate, you're back by popular demand for this year's conference after that sizzling performance of sexy scenes at the last one.
Thank you. I'm glad everyone enjoyed it so much.
What was the highlight of the last conference for you?
I think the highlight for me was the fact that we were drawing together a whole group of people in Australia who love historical fiction and have never really before had a real community. And so the Historical Novel Society Australasia is bringing together people who love to read it, who love to write it, and who love anything to do with the past. And so there was a great feeling of excitement and energy and of coming home.
And you're making an encore of the racy writing readings this year, but you're also participating in a very different session with Deborah Challenor on writing in different forms, because you wrote fantasy novels for kids before launching into historical fiction for adults. Was that a conscious move for you?
Well, see, the thing is, it's a little bit more complicated than that. I've always written for adults. I've always written for children. Some of my novels have been fantastical and some of my novels have been historical. They are kind of on a spectrum. They all draw upon the past. They all draw upon folklore and myth and fairy tale. They all draw together threads of romance and mystery and suspense. It's just a slightly different weaving together of these threads. I've always loved historical fiction. I have read it avidly ever since I was a child. And I've always loved stories of magic and adventure. So I just simply go where the story takes me. It's not that I set out consciously to write a particular type of story. It's more that the idea comes to me, it electrifies me, it energizes me. I'm completely enraptured with this story idea, and so then I just do what the story tells me to do. The story tells me what it wants to be, and I just simply do it, you know, as I'm told.
It's the boss of you, that story.
It's the boss of me, that's right. I think that the act of creativity is always one of sort of humbling yourself and sublimating yourself in service of what you are doing. And so I consciously try and do that. I consciously, you know, follow the story where it takes me and tell the story in the best possible form and the best possible shape for that particular story.
So that's really interesting. Your approach then sounds a bit like the edges between fantasy and fairy tale and the past are pretty fuzzy, aren't they?
Well, fluid, I think, might be. Okay. Yeah. And see, the thing is that I've been writing for quite a long time now. This year is actually the 20th anniversary of my first novel being published. And 20 years is a considerable amount of my life. And so as I have grown up and got older, I have grown and changed. And so my writing has grown and changed as well. A lot of my children's books were written when I had young children. And so my time, I had had very little time, and I was reading a great deal of children's fiction because I had young children. So I was reading them picture books, I was reading them early readers, and I was writing stories for them. But, you know, my children are aged now 18, 16, and 12, and so they no longer want me to tell them bedtime stories and to write stories for them. And so I'm no longer writing books for younger children because I haven't got that, that impetus to tell stories, you know, for my young children. And so I think it's just a natural progression. As my life has changed, so has my writing.
And when you're writing historical fiction in particular, I'm just thinking about the sorts of the last few books that you've written have all been placed in very specific times and very specific places or environments. Do you feel the need to go to those places? I can imagine you swanning around the Cotswolds.
My husband calls it swanning around as well, or gallivanting.
Gallivanting.
He says, oh, what gallivanting again are you?
No, it's very serious research, gallivanting.
It's very serious research that just happens to be a tax-deductible trip to the most extraordinary places on Earth.
There's a pro tip for you.
I mean, you know, Bitter Greens was set in Paris and the south of France and in Venice. How lucky was I? But I didn't set the story there because I wanted to go to Venice. The story had to be set in Venice, and so I was lucky enough to have to go there. But in answer to your question, yes, I personally think that it's very, very important. It's quite difficult to explain exactly how I feel about it. It's not just simply seeing the place and smelling it and hearing it and imagining myself into that place. When I actually do my research trips quite a long way into my writing process, and when I go to the places that the book is set, I'm not there as myself so much. I've imagined myself into the skin of my characters. And so when I go to these places, I'm there in their skin. And the very best example that I can give you is the Louvre in Paris. With Bitter Greens, my heroine is a young noblewoman called Charlotte Rose de la Force. She's second cousin to the Sun King, and she's maid of honour to the Queen. And the Louvre was the royal palace, and so she lived there. And so when I was there, I was imagining myself, you know, wearing enormously large and heavy skirt, which is what they wore in the 17th century, with layers and layers of stiffened whalebone corsets and petticoats, and a high lace fontages on my head, which was like a construction of wire and lace that would have dug deep into her scalp. And she was a noblewoman, which meant that due to the sumptuary laws, she was permitted to wear heels of about 4 inches high. And, of course, if you were permitted to wear high heels, you didn't wear flat shoes because only peasants wore flat shoes. And so she was there standing, because she wasn't permitted to sit in the company of the king, standing in this enormously heavy skirt, enormously high heels, very uncomfortable shoes, very uncomfortable headwear, for hours and hours and hours, waiting on a vain and selfish queen. When I was in the Louvre, I was within her skin. I was imagining what it must have been like for her, so stifled, so constrained, so caged. Now, I went to the Louvre again a few months ago, last year, but that time I was in the character of the heroine of my new book, Beauty in Thorns, who was a little English country violet. She was the daughter of a Methodist minister. She'd never travelled outside England. She dressed like a little Puritan because she called Victorian fashion the cloven hoof of fashion. And by that time, the Louvre was an art gallery. The Bonapartes had spent millions and millions of francs and had stolen artworks from all over the world, or all over Europe anyway. And it had just been turned into this extremely decadent and luxurious art gallery. And she's walking around in her little grey gown and her little darned gloves with her bonnet on her head, and she's shocked by these giant paintings of naked satyrs and goddesses romping with Pan, and kings and queens in their velvets and furs and diamonds. And she's shocked and she's horrified. And so the experience of Charlotte Rosa Force and the experience of Georgiana Burne-Jones in the Louvre were completely different experiences. And I was not at the Louvre in my own skin. I was there in their skin.
So that's fascinating. So that means that by the time you get to the place, you've not just got the characters in your mind, but you've clearly done a huge amount of research on all those tiny little historical details that you outlined.
Yes. People find it counterintuitive that I do my research trips towards the end of the book, not at the beginning of the book. But when I began my book, I didn't even know I was going to have a scene in the Louvre. Mm. How could I possibly have known where to go or what to look for? So yes, I try and do it as close to the end of the book as possible.
So where does a story like Beauty and Thorns start for you? Did it start with the character or with an idea?
I always start with a story idea. It's normally something that I have been interested in for a long time, but something sparks an electrical reaction for me. The Beauty and Thorns is the story of the Pre-Raphaelites, and in particular, it's the story behind the painting of an incredibly beautiful and iconic series of paintings by Edward Burne-Jones, which were finished in 1890. And his paintings were the Mona Lisa of the Victorian Britain. The queues to see these paintings stretched for blocks and blocks and blocks. They had to have policemen there to help all the fainting ladies and all the crowds pushing to get in. Edward Burne-Jones at that point was a struggling artist who had been rejected and even sneered at for decades by the Academy. And this series of paintings transformed him into the most famous artist of the times. He ended up being knighted, and the painting sold for 15,000 guineas, which was the largest price ever paid for any British painter. And these paintings of Sleeping Beauty, which are absolutely iconic paintings, any one of you would recognize them if you saw them, because we've seen them on countless calendars and cards and all over the internet. He had actually been obsessed with this Sleeping Beauty fairy tale since he was a young man. He met Georgiana, who was then Georgiana MacDonald, when she was just 12 years old and he was 17. And she shared with him her favourite fairy tale, which was Sleeping Beauty. And he painted it almost half a dozen times over the next 40 years, culminating in this, in these extremely famous paintings in 1890. And so it's a story behind the paintings. And it's a story of love and passion and death and desire, madness, obsession, betrayal. Really, whenever I find a story like this, I just feel so incredibly blessed. I'm the one that gets to tell it. And I get terribly worried that someone else is going to tell the story before I can do it, because it takes me so long. But really, it is the most extraordinary love story, and not at all what people think of when they think of the Pre-Raphaelites.
So also, I understand it's the story of the women in that group who are often overlooked.
So, the book is told from the point of view of four women. Those women are Georgie Burne-Jones, who married Edward Burne-Jones and was, to begin with, his model and muse. Then Lizzie Siddle, who is most famous for having modelled for John Everett Millais and the picture of the drowning Ophelia, which is at the Tate Britain. She famously had to lie in a tin bath filled with freezing water in his artist studio in the depths of the London winter, and all the candles and lamps blew out and he didn't notice because he was so in the trance of painting. And she lay there in that bath for 5 hours, ended up getting pneumonia and almost died. And as a consequence of that, she was given laudanum and she became addicted to laudanum. She had a very passionate love affair with another of the Pre-Raphaelite artist, Dante Gabriel Rossetti, ended up marrying him, but after their child was born dead, she plunged deeper into depression and addiction, and ended up dying of a laudanum overdose. And Dante Gabriel Rossetti famously buried his only manuscript of poems with her in her coffin, and 7 years later he had her body exhumed so he could retrieve his manuscript poems. Wonderful story. Isn't such a gift it? To a novelist. And so it's a story of Lizzie and told in her voice. And then the third woman is that of Janie Burden, who was discovered by Dante Gabriel Rossetti and Edward Burne-Jones in a theatre in Oxford. She was a girl from the slums, very, very poor, had no other way of life. And she ended up being rescued and marrying William Morris, who's most famous, of course, for his wallpapers and furnishings, but he was an absolute Renaissance man in Victorian times, an architect, a designer, an artist, and a poet. And she ended up having a secret affair with Dante Gabriel Rossetti that lasted many years, and they had this kind of menage a trois where William Morris hired a house where Janie and Dante Gabriel Rossetti could be alone together. So most of the story is told from the point of view of these three women. And then the final part of the story is told from the point of view of Margot Burne-Jones, the daughter of Georgie and Edward Burne-Jones. And she was the final model. She was the model for the Sleeping Beauty. And her father painted her obsessively for 5 or 6 years, you know, from the age of about 15, the age of about 21. And she was the model for the famous Sleeping Beauty paintings that changed all their lives.
So this book and also, The Wild Girl, you know, you're often writing about real people, people who really lived.
Yes.
And in fact, real women who in some ways have been not ignored by history, or Dorchin Wilde, certainly, you could argue that she was. How much do you imagine when you're writing about a real person, a real moment in history, and how much is based on fact?
Let me try and explain how I work. Bitter Greens is the story of a woman who once lived, Charlotte Rose de la Force. She was a real woman. She lived in the late 17th century. She was part of the fairy tale telling tradition of the late 17th century. And there was very little known about her life, very little. But there was one paragraph on the French Wikipedia. And there was one, there was a few lines in a few books, and there was one biography of hers, about 50 pages long, written by a French academic, which I had to have translated into English. And that was all that I had. And so, for example, in this biography of hers, there's a single line that says, during the infamous affair of the poisons, Mademoiselle de la Force came to the attention of the king. Now, that's a single sentence, and I managed to spin that out into about three chapters. I had to go and research the infamous affair of the poisons. I had to understand what it meant to come to the attention of the king, which simply meant that she was accused of being part of a circle of witchcraft, a famous scandal that happened at the court of Louis XIV. And she would have been put on trial by the Chambre Ardente, which was like the Inquisition, the French Inquisition. And many, many women ended up being put in the Bastille. So, of course, I couldn't not put her in the Bastille, could I? So I don't know whether or not she... I know that she came to the attention of the king. I know that this is a coded way for saying that she was investigated for witchcraft, during this period. I know that many other women what happened to them, because I read the trial transcripts. There's no trial transcript for Charlotte Rose because she was the king's kin, his second cousin. But from that, I was able to have a very dramatic scene of her on trial for witchcraft, locked up in the Bastille, and how she managed to, outwit and win her way free. So my method of working is to take all the known facts and I make them my immovable pegs, and then around them I weave my imagination. What I'm always searching for is what is most likely to have happened and what is most psychologically true. What is most likely to have been the reason to have driven people to do these things? For example, talking about the Wild Girl, again, I had nothing. I had much less than I had with Bitter Greens. With Dorchin Veald, I had the date of her death and the date of her marriage, and I had a three-paragraph memoir dictated to her daughter on her deathbed. Nothing else. We didn't even know the date of her birth. And so I had to hire an investigator in Germany to go through the parish records in Kassel to try and find the date of her christening. And we know, or I found out, that in Lutheran Germany, children were christened the Sunday after their birth. And so, from that, I was able to identify the week of her birth, but not her actual birth date. It's like a detective work. I start with very, very little, and then I discover all the known facts and I build these timelines, and then I find out what the lives of women, other women, were like, and use that as a springboard to imagine what my heroine's life would have been like. And I don't change the facts. In The Wild Girl, Dorchin Veald told Wilhelm Grimm one quarter of all the fairy tales published in the first edition of the Grimm fairy tales, one quarter of them, when she was 18 and he was in his early 20s, and yet they did not marry till she was 30. 12 years is an awfully long time to sustain sexual tension and to sustain suspense over how, whether these two young people in love are ever going to get together. But I didn't change the date. I submitted to this true story.
So it sounds like the gaps in history actually enable that world of imagination that you get to play in, and you've got the imagination working together.
Absolutely. But, my quest all the time is, people say, it's all about making the best story that you can. I don't actually believe that's true, because I do feel a certain need to be as true to their lives as I can be. And so I'm not always searching for what's going to make the best story, i.e. a compelling page turner. I'm searching to find this, the inner psychological truth of what I think happened. It's not known. History is full of mysteries, and it's those mysteries that intrigue me and fascinate me and draw me in. I sometimes say that, of these, of the four books that I have written in the past 8 years, all of them are about forgotten women. What you said earlier was absolutely right. They're all about forgotten women whose stories have not been told, particularly not in their own voices. And so I feel as if I'm rescuing them from, some kind of oubliette of history. I'm giving them the chance to tell their own stories in their own voices. And I feel a great need to be as respectful as possible to those women, to find their voice, not my voice, but to find their voice. Now, Georgie Byrne Jones was the easiest of all the women whose lives I recreated, because she wrote. She wrote hundreds of letters. She wrote a memoir of her husband, which is, I think, the best memoir or biography written in Victorian times. Her voice just rings so clear in it. And so it was very easy for me to find her voice. Charlotte Rose de la Force, you know, she wrote stories, letters, all sorts of things in French, in 17th century French. But her voice was easy for me to find as well. But Dortchen Wild, she wrote nothing. She was a storyteller, and she told her stories to Wilhelm Grimm, and he transcribed them and rewrote them in his own voice. And so recreating her voice, finding her voice, was, I think, the biggest challenge of all, and I think perhaps the one I'm most proud of.
She's a storyteller like you're a storyteller. So
Thank you.
Are all storytellers in a way, aren't they?
They all are. That's exactly right. The Beast Garden, which is was my last published novel, is the only one which isn't about women who were writers and storytellers and fairy tale tellers, because it's about the women of the German underground resistance. And they were women who had been silenced. They couldn't, you know, write letters or diaries describing their you know, resistance activities, because it was too dangerous. The Gestapo were watching them. And so, again, they were soundless. I mean, there are a few letters and a few scraps of information in their voices, but, again, I had very little to work with. And so that is, I think, probably the greatest work of imagination out of my adult historical novels, is imagining their lives and imagining what it must have been like to have lived in Berlin, you know, during the reign of Hitler. And again, I had to read, you know, the letters and diaries and memoirs of other women and men too, you know, written after the war or written during the war and hidden, to give me some sense of what their lives might have been like.
And you also have to try and recreate those worlds. I can imagine, say, for example, with the Morris group and the Pre-Raphaelites, a world of brilliant detail, like a Morris wallpaper or one of those amazing embroidery works that Jane and May Morris did, that you can still see at Kelmscott Manor. So how do you render those words on the page?
Well, see, I think that is one of the true tasks of the writer, is to make the world, the invented world, the fictional world, so vividly real that the reader finds themselves completely entranced, completely lost in that world, so much so that the real world fades away from them. They forget themselves and their own world, and they are totally, totally immersed in the world of the book. It's what I search for when I'm reading, that total immersive reading experience, and it's what I try and give to my readers as well. And the only way that you can do it is to actually immerse yourself into the world. And so when I'm working on a book, everything I read, everything I watch, everything I do is about trying to understand that world and feel myself within it as well. And this, it does limit my reading or what I do quite a bit. When I was writing The Beast Garden, you know, my family and I, we just watched endless documentaries about Hitler and the Gestapo and everything else. And it was like my Friday night routine was to have a glass of wine and watch another Hitler documentary. You know, I think my whole family was so glad when I finished that book. But I often cook the meals that they would have eaten. I read the books that they would have read. I try and find out as much as I can about what their daily lives were like. You know, luckily for me, there are so many wonderful resources for writers, you know, so many amazing historians who have their own obsessive regard for whatever place and time it is. The Pre-Raphaelites and, you know, sitting a story in Victorian Britain, I mean, there are hundreds of books about what life was like, and I've got many of them on my shelf now. The Victorian City, you know, what a time traveler's guide to Victorian England, everyday life in the 1800s, life below stairs, how to be a Victorian, the Victorian house. I'm just reading off my underworld London.
We're very lucky, aren't we?
So lucky. it was much easier than, you know, writing The Wild Girl, which was set in, you know, Hessen Castle in the early 1800s. It was, there was very little written about it. But luckily they had, the local library had a local history and a local historian who really helped me. Even though my German is very poor and his English was very poor, we managed to communicate quite well.
So that's an added complexity when you're researching a place set. It's not just a different time, but it's also you're having to research in a different language, in French or in German.
Resources. So when I was working on The Wild Girl, the first, so there are various editions of the Grimm fairy tales, and there's one which is which was never published, which is called the 1810 manuscript. It was lost. It was the Grimm brothers sent it to a friend of theirs, and he lost it. And most people think now he lost it on purpose because of professional jealousy. But it was found in 1930s in Germany, and was published, but only in German. And so I had to get a copy of it, and I had to translate it myself into English because it had never been translated into English. It has since been translated, much better than my own. But if you can imagine me laboring away on this manuscript in German, which was written in High German, not in Low German, and so a lot of the words were very different. If you could see my laborious translation of this, I mean, it was such a work of love, and it took me days and days and days, but I needed to do it.
Yeah.
Needed to be done.
So, Kate, thank you so much for being part of this podcast series. And
thank you, Kelly.
Look forward to seeing you in September at the conference.
I look forward to seeing you so much and hearing all about all your new adventures as well.
So thank you very much, and thanks everybody for listening.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Imagining the Past. It's a sneak preview of some of the writers and issues showcased in this year's conference of the Historical Novel Society of Australasia. In Melbourne, from the 8th to the 10th of September, the conference will explore ideas around identity and writing in historical fiction. There'll be interviews, practical workshops, debates, and academic panels. You'll hear from the likes of Kerry Greenwood, Arnold Zabel, Kate Forsyth, and Melissa Ashley. And our podcast guests, including Deborah Challenor, Lucy Trelaw, Sophie Masson, Zulara Gentil, and Robert Gott. And me, I'm Kelly Gardner. You can find out more or buy tickets online from hnsa.org.au.